archivist and curator of the special collections at Stuart Library, Weber State University. He's professor of libraries and editor of Historian's Apprentice, The Diaries of B.H. Roberts, Mormon Mavericks, Essays on Mormon Dissenters, and one other book back there. All three of the books are available for purchase. I'm going to quote from the back of Mormon Mavericks, who he co-authored with Susan Stakers. Some left, some stayed. Each one found some aspect of their church's history, doctrine, policies, or politics that they could not reconcile with their own personal ethics. Some felt burdened by the conflict, while others embraced it. A few were reticent, even apologetic about their disagreements. Others were barnstormers. Each possessed some quality that destined him or her to ride at the fringes rather than at the center. And in discussing Brigham H. Roberts, those of us who have read substantially about him as well as his writings know that he enters the area of fringe at least certain times in his life. Now, John, the people who are here range widely. There are some non-Mormons in the audience, but there are also some Mormons who are complete non-believers, and there are some Mormons at the other end of the spectrum who are complete believers. And they range the whole thing in between. Every writer, every presenter, every author comes at his topic with certain assumptions or orientation. These assumptions and orientation will determine the audience he is addressing, but will also lead him to certain conclusions. Now, it seems to us that you have focused on fringe people in your writings. Would you be so kind as to help us in evaluating and orienting ourselves to you, and perhaps start out by telling us your own orientation and assumptions concerning, for example, Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, and supernatural claims of Mormonism? Anything else? Well, I want to thank Bob for that introduction, I think. Let me simply say that I'm still the sweet spirit I was two hours ago. My orientation is that I am no longer a member of the church, though I was a member of the church for 25 years. Currently am not. I'm interested in Mavericks and people at the margins because they tend to be pretty interesting. Some of them you would like to have spent your time with, and some of them you probably wouldn't, but all of them enrich our lives by what they have to say about the world around them. I don't know anything about Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, and the other questions you asked that would in any way add to what the knowledge I see in front of me is. So I hope that answers it. In March 1882, a 25-year-old missionary from a small Utah town serving in rural Tennessee recorded the following plaintive confession. Perhaps one half of my life has passed away, and what have I done? But little of anything, either of good or evil. My misdeeds are like my talents, on the small order. I've made attempts to accomplish something in various directions, but miserable failure is written across the face of each of them. I can but choose to regret the past when looking over it, but as I cannot call it back to amend it or straighten out the crooks which appear in the path I have trod, I will look to the present and future and try to profit by the experience of the past. Written as only a 25-year-old might write it. The author of this diary entry was B.H. Roberts, who would live a remarkably full and productive life by anyone's standard but his own. And I remember the first time I read that passage thinking, my heavens, man, you've got a half a century ahead of you. And in that half century between March of 1882 and Roberts' death in September of 1933, his achievements surpassed those of most of his contemporaries in religion, politics, and scholarship. Still, he remained somewhat dissatisfied with himself and occasionally suffered bouts of depression. In many ways, B.H. Roberts represented a new generation of Mormons born after the trials of Nauvoo and the trek to the Great Basin who sought to understand and chronicle the historical and theological importance of their faith. As Sterling McMurrin, a name you might know, observed, Roberts lived during a crucial period for Mormonism. The original prophetic and sectarian impulses were waning, and the struggles with the federal government and their aftermath were taking a severe toll of human energy and threatening the economic and institutional life of the church. More than anything else, the church needed defenses that would justify its existence, establish its moral and intellectual responsibility, and guarantee its own integrity. There were other issues, including the struggle for statehood, the creation of a different political culture in the state of Utah for both Mormons and Gentiles alike, and the challenges posed by science and secular thought. Roberts, McMurrin elaborated, entered into these debates with quiet, remarkable energy and dedication, and with the self-assurance and determination of those whose commitment and faith are firm. Recently, as Bob mentioned, Signature Books published my edited collection, History's Apprentice, The Diaries of B.H. Roberts, 1880 to 1898. I should say to you that not every year is included in that period, that 18-year period, and not each year that is included is a full year. Nonetheless, I think they are valuable diaries. They tell us a lot about B.H. Roberts and the Mormon experience. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is talk about the diaries themselves, what they tell us about B.H. and the Mormon experience, and perhaps what they don't tell us, which in some ways may be as interesting as well. Before discussing the diaries themselves, it may be helpful to review Roberts' life. He was born Brigham Henry Roberts on 13 March 1857 in Warrington, Lancashire, England, to Benjamin and Anne Everington Roberts. His parents were converts to Mormonism, but Anne's commitment was stronger than Benjamin's. This, along with Benjamin's intemperate habits and wild cravings for independence, convinced Anne to leave her husband and immigrate to the United States in 1862. Taking two of her children, Annie and a baby son named Thomas, who died on the trek west, she left her teenage daughter Mary, who was usually referred to as Polly, with a relative named Martin Pye, and the five-year-old Brigham, who in those days was known as Harry, with a Mormon couple named the Toveys. All was not well for the Roberts children, especially since the two families lacked the means to support them. Polly earned her keep working at the kiln that Pye operated. Harry's life was even more Dickensian. He said he was barely fed and clothed and worked alongside Mr. Tovey in the stone trade, where he learned to prepare sand for marble polishing and to carry a water bucket on his head. At the end of a tiring day, he came home to a scanty meal and slept on a bare floor with no covers. Over the years, the privations continued. The Toveys tried several times to rid themselves of their young burden by apprenticing him or signing him up to be a drummer boy in the army. Each time, young Harry ran away until the threat had passed and then returned home. Eventually, local Mormons procured the means through the church's perpetual immigration fund to rescue Harry and Polly from their circumstances. The two young children departed from Liverpool for America in April of 1866 on board the ship, the John Bright. 2 months later, on 6 June, Roberts was in New York Harbor, waiting along with a large company of Mormon immigrants to embark for Utah. More than 65 years later, while dictating his autobiography, this scene and the emotions surrounding it were still vivid in Roberts' mind. Quoting from him now, "I was a boy of no prepossessing appearance. In the first place, I was clad in just a pair of barn door trousers and a jacket made from the old trousers of an English policeman, a pair of iron-rimmed wooden clogs, and on my head was what was supposed to be a jaunty Scotch cap, faced with bright plaid around the rim and ended in two black streamers behind, a headgear I heartily despised. There was no joy in boyhood in my appearance, no disposition to mill around with the 700 other immigrants. I seemed to be without companions, and they doubtless would have been repulsed by me if they had manifested friendliness. I was a boy accustomed to being alone, apart from the throng. I was not restless, but rather solemn and gloomy." you're beginning to see the hints of melancholy in his life. In mid-July, Harry and Polly joined William Henry Chipman's wagon train west and arrived in Great Salt Lake Valley 2 months later. The memory again remained distinct in Roberts' mind as he recalls that the train, falling into its old line, swung down the low foothills until they struck a well-defined road leading into the city. As Captain Chipman's immigrants traveled down Immigration Street, which is today's Third South, and turned onto Main Street, young Harry found himself, again in his words, at the head of the lead yoke of that team, walking up the principal street of the city, the rest of the team following. He was literally leading the parade. Here the people had turned out to welcome the plains-worn immigrants and were standing on the street sides to greet them. Along the road, I saw a charming little girl approach me in the middle of the street. It was a strange meeting, we two. Though the dainty little lady was timid in approaching Harry, who by his own admission was an ugly duckling and unkempt, his clothes ill-fitting and with a shock of unmanageable hair, she offered him a fruit basket of peaches, plums, and grapes. Roberts took what he supposed was a reasonable portion, shared them with his sister, and then resumed his place at the front of the train and marched on until the head of Main Street was reached. It is a captivating and illuminating scene in the life of B.H. Roberts. One senses for the very first time in his life, Roberts was finally, ironically, after that long journey, at home. This sense of belonging, geographically and spiritually, marked him the rest of his life. Despite the conflicts, defeats, and disappointments he would encounter in his later life, he was at core a Latter-day Saint and a Utah, even if by adoption rather than birth. The siblings accompanied their mother to her small unfinished house in Bountiful, north of Salt Lake City. During their absence, Anne had married an English convert named John William Nichols and had given birth to another daughter, Elizabeth Audrey. It's a little vague whether or not Anne and Benjamin were divorced, and if so, when, but she had contracted this other marriage. Then this husband had died in a farm accident, and Anne was left to raise Elizabeth and young Annie alone. A year later, a new stepfather named Seth Dustin baptized Harry into the LDS faith. Despite the financial stability of Dustin that Dustin contributed to the family, the union proved as ill-fated as Anne's other marriages. From the beginning, Roberts felt uncomfortable around Dustin's older sons, who were, in his words, ignorant in their manners and boisterous in their conduct. He worked for his stepfather, grading a railroad bed between Salt Lake City and Ogden, and he also accompanied Dustin in search of coal in the Wasatch Mountains and prospecting for silver in Dry Canyon near Ophir. Roberts learned the way of miners, including fighting, gunplay, profanity, gambling, and the company of men of very irregular habits. He was again in the presence of the demon of alcohol, which had previously trapped his father, the Tobies, and others in his life, unaware that it would become a frequent companion of his own in the future. After resisting offers to imbibe, he remembered that it was near sunset one day when he yielded to the solicitation and drank a half-tin cup full of the fiery liquor. Its effect upon me, unpracticed in that kind of beverage, can be imagined. I was soon in the swirl of intoxication with a reckless daredevil spirit that had been awakened. Not uncommon for some folks. Drunk and out of control, Roberts mounted a scarcely broken 3-year-old colt and challenged his co-workers to a race until the horse bucked him off, the men dumped him in a wagon to sleep it off. In the morning, his companions advised him to treat his hangover with a bit of the hair of the dog that bit him. He declined. At some point, Roberts decided to turn his life around and accepted an apprenticeship with a Centerville blacksmith named James Baird. This allowed him to associate with boys of better upbringing at the Young Men's Club of Centerville, a forerunner of the Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association. He not only found better companionship, the club also had a sizable library of historical and theological volumes. Over time, intellectual pursuits began to replace the tendency on Roberts' part to live life on the margins. Before long, he was attending the University of Deseret in Salt Lake, courting, then marrying Sarah Louisa Smith, who's generally referred to as Louisa, the daughter of a prominent Davis County family. Her dad was the state president, and he was teaching school in Centerville. In the wake of the changes that had happened in his life, Roberts received a call to serve his first mission, which was the initial step in a long career of church service. And as you know, he later became a general authority and was elected to Congress, though not seated. He had a very long, distinguished career and as an author as well. Well, let's turn to the diaries themselves for just a few minutes and see how they might help us better understand B.H. and his times. In many ways, these diaries that I've collected in History's Apprentice that cover the period from 1880 to 1898 are the day-to-day record of the kinds of activities that any missionary of the day might have been involved in, tracting, visiting members, and worrying about home. The difference in proselytizing then and now is that in Roberts' day, instead of knocking in on doors, he and his companions tended to book a public hall, post notices that they would be speaking, and hope for a crowd, which more often than not materialized in the South, the Bible Belt South. In a pre-media era, people attended lectures, especially if they were promised a debate with these Mormon upstarts by a local minister. The elders also held informal meetings in the evenings at people's homes and otherwise seemed to have the daytime to themselves to read and prepare for evening appointments or walk to their next destination. This interesting view of 19th century missionary work is augmented by Roberts' information in the diaries about specific baptisms and the incipient church organization in the South, for which apparently there is no other extant documentation. Branches organized that we don't know anything about except what B.H. has to say. Roberts is straightforward in his prose and only occasionally shares something of his feelings for his family. There are appropriate notes about his family's health and childbirths, much more staid in tone than in the letters he was writing home at the same time. For instance, when he had been away from his family for about 2 years, he wrote to Louisa on 10 February 1882 about an incident that had taken place in Nashville. After leaving our valises at the boarding house, we took a walk. As we were going around a corner, three ladies stepped in front of us. I noticed one of them was about your height. And as she turned her face to look across the street, I caught a side view of her face. There was your nose, your eyes, and your mouth. My breath came fast. I could scarcely keep from rushing forward and pressing her to my throbbing heart. But knowing you were far away in the West, I concluded it could not be you, so held myself. But I tell you now, it would hardly do for me to run on you unaware. It wouldn't do. It wouldn't do. Roberts included a short romantic poem and said that his heart was filled with joy and love, that he missed his wife much at twilight. He was growing tired, he wrote, and was about to seek the solitude of his lonely couch. The letter is signed to his two precious gems, his wife and their daughter Ada, then more formally signed as yours most truly, B.H. Roberts. The most intimate information in the diaries concerns Roberts' dreams. He dutifully noted that what he considered to be significant themes and mined them for insights and inspiration. One evening, for example, he writes, he returned to his hotel and received a gruff reception from the hotel keeper, which reminded him that he had dreamt the night before of fighting a snake, and it gave me some trouble. But I finally began hitting it, and it became smaller and smaller until it dwindled to nothing. And this man, he says, was this dream fulfilled, for he gave me some trouble, but finally he ceased to contend with us. In addition to dreams, Roberts received premonitions that directed his activities in times of difficulty. On several occasions, he recorded these promptings in his diary. They document not only his spirituality, but also his recurring depression or melancholy, which marked his life and how he dealt with it. As we know, both from the diaries and from other sources, Roberts was never far most of his life from alcohol. As I've mentioned, his father was a heavy drinker, as were the Toveys that had who he lived with for a few years. As he recalled about the Toveys, Notwithstanding their church membership, the Tobys were both addicted to periodical heavy drinking. And as I afterwards remembered, most of their evenings were spent in country taverns and city saloons, ending frequently in absolute drunkenness. To these taverns and saloons they dragged me with them, who curled up under the tables where the drinking went on and slept. It is almost impossible to understand the B.H. Roberts you and I know without understanding the absolute stark nature of his first 7 or 8 years. This was a truly, in many ways, dysfunctional family, and this was a child literally raised in the taverns of England. And this was a child who, in many ways, felt abandoned by his mother, who had escaped, who had gone to America with the other children. As I noted, Roberts took a drink when he was prospecting in Utah. In his diaries, he talks about this, about alcohol as well. On January 28th of 1881, he recorded in his diary, "I feel bad because my old weakness still is not overcome, but I am still determined to overcome it." Some people suggest that was alcohol. Some people suggest that was depression. I think it was probably both somewhat combined. I think he used the alcohol to self-medicate at times, as you will see in a minute. 2 years later, in an entry dated September 20th, 1883, he seemed to contradict himself about what he'd said in January of 81, when he noted that because he was suffering much from headache, he took a dram of rye whiskey, the first I ever took while on a mission. The whiskey deadened the pain, but Roberts was still suffering the next day and felt about as ill, he said, as I ever was in my life. After the elders administered to him, he fell into a sleep, from which I awoke much better, but far from well. As an aside, I mentioned to somebody who had known Roberts as a young man before Roberts died, I read to him this passage, and his response was, he frequently took a little bit more than a dram of whiskey. While the Tobys introduced Roberts to English drinking establishments, they opened another world to him as well, one that became a major force in his life. One day, while hiking through a beautiful countryside of England and resting with Mrs. Toby in the shade of a hedgerow, Roberts noticed a few pages of a newspaper. In his words, "I rushed out and gathered them up and brought them to the old lady, begging her to read to me. And here should be said in this matter of the old lady reading to me was something of a passion with me. She read the scriptures to her husband when evenings were spent home, and I listened very often entranced. Sometimes the church paper called the Latter-day Saints Millennial Star was read. Somewhere about this time, an anti-Mormon book was published in England, Samuel Mosheim Schmucker's History of the Mormons. It is usually conceded to be the fairest anti-Mormon account of Joseph Smith and the religion he founded. His discussion of the martyrdom of the prophet at Carthage was vivid, as also were the engravings illustrating it. This was a choice section of the book to me, and I pleaded frequently for it to be read to me. Old Mrs. Toby was kind enough to do this." And so began a largely self-taught education with an emphasis on literature and history. Roberts often mentions with pride the volumes he bought while traveling, the books he read, the influence of the ideas on his own thinking. Moreover, the diaries contain a hint of another passion in his life. At a very early age, the desire to be a writer. And there's early evidence of his growing ability in this area in the diaries. Another interesting aspect of the diaries is the importance of travel, which was a pleasant byproduct of the missionary experience. In the 19th century, proselytizing was the only means the LDS Church really had to increase the fold. But for Roberts, a mission, though clearly predicated on his religious duty, provided an ongoing education that he appreciated. One senses that while he missed hearth and home, he nevertheless enjoyed the camaraderie, the diversity, and the excitement he experienced in England and elsewhere. The missions brought him closer to culture and ideas which were unavailable in Davis County, then and now. While on his sojourns, he visited the homes of his favorite writers, and he toured historic sites, attended other churches' services, and enjoyed plays and musical performances. They gave B.H. Roberts and other 19th century missionaries a broader, if not always enlightened, worldview. In this regard, I would suggest to you the look in the diary to compare his glowing accounts of England when he was there in 1887 to escape prosecution for plural marriage with his condescending attitude for the unsophisticated and disorganized ways of many of the Mexicans he encountered when he was in that mission in the early 1890s. While a mission afforded Roberts the chance to travel and to grow personally, like any missionary then or now, he experienced doubts and a strong desire to return home. On 18 February 1881, he wrote the following. "The last few days have let my mind run upon the things of this world, and in consequence thereof, I have become somewhat restless. My mind has been planning how I am to make money in the future. But my business now is to preach the gospel, and I trust God will aid me to keep my mind upon my ministry." He was a serious 26-year-old, let me tell you. Not only are the diaries valuable for their explicit explanations of doctrine and missionary activities, they are sometimes telling for what they do not say. Although Robert spent the greater part of 5 years in the South, some of that in the very deep South, he makes almost no reference to blacks, to segregation, to post-Civil War reconstruction. On 12 January 1881, he observed that half the population of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, was colored. But he observes it only as a fact, not as a springboard for any interpretation or speculation. There's some difference between the diaries and his recent, here is, published autobiography, which he dictated toward the end of his life. In the autobiography, for example, he recalled his journey from Iowa to Tennessee, where he had been initially on his mission. That season, there had been a large exodus of the Negro race from the South, and now, under the pressure of the intensity of the cold weather, that migration was leading southward. At one point, some distance from St. Louis, at the close of the first day of delayed travel, the train was boarded by an immense number. In fact, all that could be crowded in the car of rivermen and Negroes took place. To that point, the railroad coach, had been occupied wholly by a young southern man from Kentucky on his way home and me. As the crowding began, the young man came to Roberts and proposed an alliance between us, offensive and defensive, against this onrush, so that our throats would not be cut and our bodies not thrown from the train. Admitting that he had not thought to carry a firearm, Roberts welcomed the alliance. At a layover, the pair sought shelter from the cold in a crowded lodging house. A young black boy in the office informed them of an available room that was occupied, he said, by a colored man. Roberts told the young clerk not to disturb that man of color and instead opted to huddle on the chairs and tables in the outer office. So the record is mixed. One could wish that Roberts had paid attention to the social conditions in Tennessee and elsewhere while he was laboring there. But he makes no mention of preaching to or tracting among black residents, even though the surnames he identified, Huddleston, Sanders, and others, were shared by black and white families, and what was listed in the census of the time, mulattoes. One suspects that if Roberts had visited colored people, he would have mentioned it. I'm suggesting then that the Mormons were not tracting to anybody other than white folks. Another interesting aspect of the mission, evident from the diaries, is that Roberts and his associates kept to the rural parts of the South and avoided the larger cities. Whether they were better received in rural areas or intimidated by the level of education and culture of urban dwellers is really not clear. In any case, when Roberts is in the country, he preaches to LDS congregations and attends their services in the branches. When Roberts is in the big cities, he limits himself to visiting other denominations' churches and sightseeing. And he is an inveterate sightseer and traveler. This was an unfortunate strategy, however, in that it brought the missionaries and church members into close contact with the recently organized Ku Klux Klan. We learn of the Klan's efforts to harass Mormons during this period, and the diaries give a feel for the kind of violence that the Mormon missionaries and some church members experienced, including a foreshadowing of the tragedy at Cane Creek in 1884, one of the most difficult chapters in Roberts's life. Roberts could not restrain himself from commenting on plural marriage, either theologically or in terms of its practical considerations. And this is one of the most interesting and important parts, I think, of these diaries. When the diaries begin, Roberts is married to Louisa, and he includes interesting details, as I've indicated, about this marriage. Along the way, we learn of his relationships with his second wife, Celia Dibble, a student of his when he's teaching school, and his third plural wife, a woman a bit older than Roberts, a medical doctor named Margaret Shipp. The prevailing view is that Roberts' third marriage occurred in 1890, approximately 6 months prior to President Woodruff's manifesto and the ostensible end of plural marriage. In his study of the church leadership, the Mormon hierarchy, however, D. Michael Quinn states that this marriage took place in 1891 after the manifesto had been issued. We don't know for sure when the marriage happened. We do know that it did take place before, I think, March of 1891, because everybody agrees that Daniel H. Wells performed the marriage, and Daniel H. Wells is dead March 15th or something of 1891. If Quinn is correct, it is significant that Roberts confided his struggle in accepting the manifesto in the diaries because he could find no good reason to obey it to the letter of the law. Let me illustrate this a bit. In the 1891-92 retrospective part of the diary, he goes back and retrospectively catches up a couple years that he has missed. He notes that he was on an extended tour of southern Utah when he learned of the manifesto. In fact, he learned of it by reading newspaper headlines. No sooner had I read them than, like a flash of light all through my soul, the Spirit said, "That is all right. This manifesto is all right," so it passed. Then I began to reflect upon the matter. I thought of all the saints who had suffered to sustain that doctrine. I remembered my own exile, my own imprisonment. I thought of others. I remembered what sacrifices my wives had made for it, and what others had made for it meaning plural marriage. We had preached it, sustained its divinity from the pulpit, in the press, from the lecture platform. Our community had endured every kind of reproach from the world for the sake of it. And this was to be the end? Clearly, Roberts is troubled by that. Roberts expresses this misgivings to a traveling companion, who is Apostle John W. Taylor. And Taylor seems to share, to some extent, Roberts says, his views. When others in the party reached them, Roberts found himself in quite an exasperated mood and felt crushed and humiliated by the decision. He was reassured by elders John Henry Smith, Abraham W. Cannon, and Francis M. Lyman, but derived little comfort from their comments and spent the rest of the journey in private reflection about what this meant, this manifesto. He began to feel somewhat reconciled to the state of affairs as General Conference approached. But at conference, President Woodruff stood and asked the church membership for its ratification. He records this in the diary. "When the crisis came, I felt heartbroken but remained silent. It seemed to me to be the awfulest moment in my life. My arm was like lead when the motion was put. I could not vote for it and did not do so." So he's torn over this question of plural marriage. He's particularly torn over the question of whether or not but if it's just Woodruff's idea, that's one thing. But if he's asking the church to go on record and ratifying it, that's something very different altogether, he is arguing. One can't help but think about part what's going on here is that Roberts, by this time even, 1890, has a bit of a reputation. And he feels like he's put himself way out on the line in defense of plural marriage, including going to England, as he mentions, and serving time in jail. So he's not very happy. He continued to be plagued by this issue over the next 2 years, but also remembered the flash of light initially that had come to him when he had first learned of the manifesto. And he says, "At last my feelings became reconciled to it," confiding that he had perhaps transgressed in not heeding his first impression. "And while allowing my own prejudice and my own short-sighted human reason to stand against the inspiration of God," He solicited earnestly the Spirit of God for a testimony that the manifesto was correct. Roberts eventually reached an accommodation with the church policy, but he continued to believe that plural marriage was an integral part of Mormonism, and that along with all other truth, it would eventually prevail and be established on the earth. And perhaps this is the conviction that led him to take that third wife, Margaret Shipp, during this period, whether it's just right before or just right after the manifesto. At this point, I can't help but thinking about that initial picture of Roberts entering the valley. Anything that was going to separate Roberts from that feeling of finally being home was difficult throughout his life, and he struggled with it. And even though he often fought with the brethren, he never really could go beyond wanting to be a part of that. In summary, the diaries reveal the stages of growth and development of a young man who was not only representative of his time and place, but whose accomplishments were remarkable. We see his character and outlook mature between 1880 and 1898. As the callow young missionary we encounter on the first page of the diary gradually fades, another more confident and somewhat worldly individual appears, in turn to be replaced by another man, a highly respected church leader. Roberts' greatest contributions were still in the future, the time he discontinued keeping a diary. But by this time, he had already served several missions, written numerous articles and books, and played an active role in politics. Furthermore, we see evidence of change in him on his 36th birthday. In contrast to his account from his 25th birthday cited above, Roberts, in his words, imagined that he was one step down from the summit of my life, so far as time is concerned. That is, if we count 70 years as the time, 70 years, allotted to man. I shall not live that allotted time. He's still a little bit unsure of how much time he has left. But these sad thoughts aside, that I won't live my full 70 years, thoughts which ever come whenever I think upon the subject, I hope that I shall live long enough to do much more than has yet been done by me. To thee, Almighty God, he says, do I dedicate this year of my life. Except it is thine, as I will endeavor to make all the years which shall follow it. But in this is not my will, but thy will be done. I am thine to do even as thou will. Only this I ask. Keep me from deadly sin, that I may not mar the hopes I have for eternal life. Thanks. I have a tough task here. I'm following three wonderful papers, a wonderful lunch, and a delightful view. But I would be willing to entertain a few questions, but I won't be brokenhearted if you want to just get up and move around a bit, please.
This is just a daddy question. So it starts when he's like 22?
He is, starts in 1880. He's not quite 23 yet.
And then he married at what age?
He marries when he is, he's married when he first got on his mission, so he marries at 21.
And then the second and third are what ages?
I'm sorry, say that again.
The second and third wife?
The second and third wife. He is 31 when he marries Celia Dibble, and he is either 43 or 44, depending on which date you accept when he marries Margaret.
And then his attempt to be, how old was he in that? When he went to
prison. That's in 1898, so he is a little over 40 by that time. He is elected and not seated. He's a delegate at the Constitutional Convention in 1895. He runs once before that and is unsuccessful, and then he is elected to Congress in 1898. But
so he had three wives at that time.
He did have three wives,
and
he had been to prison. He had three wives. He was still living with those three wives. He was still having children with those three wives. In fact, his third wife, Margaret, delivered a set of twins that B.H. had with his second wife, Celia Dibble. Margaret really becomes, I don't want to use this term, but for want of a better one, Margaret really becomes B.H.'s trophy wife. At least that's the way that many of the families of the second particularly, and somewhat the first wife, feel. That Roberts, by the time he marries Margaret, he is a much more sophisticated, well-known public figure,
and they feel that he was marrying to a station that he had arrived at. He was no longer the country bumpkin that married the daughter of the state president. And there's a fair amount of antagonism on the part of some folks to that third wife. When the first wife dies, who, as you know, would be the legal wife, Roberts will then marry civilly Margaret in Chicago, I assume, hoping that nobody will notice it. Nobody notices except the New York Times. Margaret is number three. So Margaret becomes his legal wife. And the family of Celia says, in effect, okay, you know, what have you done to us by making this the legal union? So it's pretty complicated.
Does he have children by her too?
They have no children. She has children by an earlier husband. An earlier marriage, she has several children, some of whom, most of whom don't really live to be adults, but a few do.
So he could have made all of his children legal.
Could have, and did, yeah. And made a lot of people unhappy. Charlotte.
Wasn't he a mission president in Pennsylvania?
Eastern States.
Eastern States.
He becomes a mission president, I think, in 1922 in the Eastern States, and again, he takes, though the other wives are still living, he takes Margaret with him to be his wife in the mission home. When Louisa dies, Roberts leaves with Margaret to come out to the funeral and doesn't get here in time. The funeral is already held, and it is on the trip back to the Eastern States when they're in Chicago that he has this civil marriage performed. So he's a mission president.
Well, my mother was a missionary. He encouraged the missionaries to go out to the museums and the theater and the plays and the musicals.
No, I'm not.
Concerts.
Not a bit surprised. Not a bit surprised.
And it was just, you know, it was just like a whole.
He's clearly spends all of his life trying to get beyond that. That early life, that self-education. And he will confide to his diary, you know, spent the evening playing chess and reading Dante. Cool. So I spent the evening vegging on the couch, you know. But he feels that need, and I'm not at all surprised by that. Yeah, not at all.
John, in the book of Modern Studies, which he produces in the 1990s,
yeah,
is kept secret by his family until they give them to Sterling Murren and Rick Madsen.
Yeah.
Which family had them? Which?
I think it's the first family. I think it's the question is, he produces toward the end of his life a manuscript on the Book of Mormon that's published many years after his death that was in the family's possession. I think there was also some copies floating around in other places. I'm sure it was in the possession of the first family, the Wise's family. That's a really interesting question, Roberts' view on the Book of Mormon. I don't, as I said to you when I began, I don't pretend to be an expert on the Book of Mormon in any way. But many people, the basic argument is this, that Roberts believed in the Book of Mormon for a period of time and ultimately became convinced that the Book of Mormon was a fake and spent the remaining days of his life, once that happened, trying to disprove the Book of Mormon. And you can marshal evidence that really would support either view. Though you can't marshal the kind of evidence that conclusively or definitively tells you which is correct. And I found myself engaged in a bit of a disagreement with a colleague of mine who is a grandson of B.H.'s, last baby blessed by B.H. Roberts, who very, very strongly believes that he did not in any way lose his faith in the divinity of and the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Makes a pretty strong argument. Brigham Matson, Sterling McMurrin, and some other folks make a pretty strong argument that this believer in higher criticism and reading all the avant-garde philosophers just simply moved beyond his early Mormon roots. It's clear in the diaries, and they only cover the period up through 1898, that he is a faithful defender of the Book of Mormon. His first real public notice is a series of debates he engages in Tennessee that cover the course of 3 or 4 days when he debates the Reverend Mr. Alsop on the question of, is the Book of Mormon authentic? So he's clearly a believer in the beginning. Whether he's a believer in the end, I don't know. It was very important for me to understand something. Let me just share with you. For me, B.H. Roberts is just a historical figure. He's just another subject to study. For Richard Roberts, this is his grandfather. And he's not at all objective about this. And when I understood that the way we were seeing this guy was very much influenced by that fact, I really kind of backed away and didn't really want to provoke Richard. So as historians, we sometimes need to understand that what we see as a simply objective, dispassionate sort of study for other people is very different. Question in the back, sir.
Can you tell us about the
Well, that's what he thought it was, and again, just like with the studies of the Book of Mormon, people line up on different different sides of the question of what that all means.
Well, what was it about?
Well, it's a collection of evidences on, or a collection of essays and writings on essentially the larger question of Mormon theology. But it isn't so much what he says, but the interpretation that's put on it. That's one of the few books I'm aware of that came out in two separate editions, one from BYU and one from Seminary. Each have different introductions, different essays, and I'm sure there are folks here that could really do that question more justice than I could. The only thing I would say to you is I ran into Leonard Arrington, and I said to him, Leonard, which of the two do you think's the best? And Leonard said, oh, the signature book is the best by far. And I said, is that the one you have an introduction in, Leonard? He said, oh, yeah. But it's the best. Question in the back.
Perhaps this brings this to form in the last year. Wasn't that supposed to be used as
a priesthood manual,
right. Yeah. And it was not because of one particular chapter in there?
He engages in, harkening back to our earlier session, he engages in a long Congress. He writes some of the speeches that are given at the World's Fair in 1893. He involves himself in the Parliament of Religions. Roberts clearly thinks of himself as a major Mormon intellectual figure. And the disappointments of not being seated, the disagreements with some members of the quorum, he has aspirations, I think, for higher political office. He thinks about running for the Congress again. He thinks about running for governor. He is a fairly, you know, fairly liberal Democrat toward the end of his life, you know, realistically speaking. He's no left-winger, but he's a staunch Democrat, and he certainly supported a New Deal and a kind of an internationalist Democrat in a time, again, then and now, when such policies or politics in Utah are not particularly conducive to success. So he has these disappointments, and I think in some ways he's a bitter guy. But, yes? Well, the diaries, for one. When Truman Madsen wrote his biography, he had access to some of these diaries, but not all of them.
And what part of these diaries would be different?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I teach at Weber State University.
Yay.
And a colleague of mine said to me, I've got a paper from a senior history student, and it's pretty amazing. This guy has access to all manner of church records. I said, really? That's pretty good. Some of the rest of us have a bit of a challenge getting access. And I read this young man's senior history thesis, and I knew we were in trouble when he referred to Franklin D. Richards as Franklin Delano Richards.
Okay?
And then when he quoted liberally from B.H. Roberts' diary at a particular date, I said to my colleague, he's making this up. Because B.H. Roberts didn't keep a diary for that period of time. She said, how do you know that? And I said, because I met it in the facility. She said, would you check and make sure that there is not a diary? I said, I'll check, but I know there isn't. So I got in touch with the historical department, and they said, oh, no, we don't have a diary for that period. Now, we do have a diary for 1880-81 and 1898, both of which had been in the hands of the church for about 30 years and not processed. And so nobody knew of them. And so this is an interesting combination in that some of the diaries come from the University of Utah's special collections, and some of the other diaries come from the church historical department and are put together. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly, I mean, the first page of his 82 diary refers to the last page of his 81 diary. So it's clearly the continuation. And I remember thinking to myself, B.H. Roberts, signature books, and me? There's not a chance in heck that the church is going to allow these to be published. And they did. And so...
That's so did the student need to have accurate information?
No, he just made things up.
He just made them up.
So be careful what you do. Molly?
Was Margaret Shipp related to Ellis?
Sister wives.
Sister wife of Ellis.
Sister, they were sister wives of Milford Shipp.
Of Milford Shipp, and both doctors.
And both doctors.
Can you mention your thoughts about his public debate about women and vote and how he felt about women and how he was seen in the community?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. It's a problematic issue. And when I found out that they had discovered some more diaries, I said, oh, please be for the Constitutional Convention, but they weren't. So there's nothing in the diaries to indicate why he came to the conclusion he came to on the question of the right of women to vote, suffrage. I think there's some, and there's a lot of other secondary material out there to suggest that he looked at it as a traditional man might look at it, as somewhat.
So he was against it?
He was against it, yes. He fought it in the Constitutional Convention. And, excuse me, the arguments he makes are not particularly more advanced or enlightened or all that different than the typical arguments. Woman's place is not in politics, and it's nasty, dirty business, and sort of that sort of thing. I think that in the diaries and in his early life, he clearly felt abandoned by his mother, clearly. And he really has a hard time getting beyond that abandonment. Not only does she leave him, he's 5 years old, she leaves him. He doesn't know if he'll ever see her again. He leaves him with this family of alcoholics, who every once in a while, when they're down on their luck and need a couple of shillings for some whiskey, want to apprentice him out or you know. So I don't think he really ever gets over that. And I think it really colors in many ways his relationships with women. You know, you look at, and maybe we don't have the letters and the diaries to really fully understand the question, and I'm not suggesting that there aren't some really delightful letters between B.H. and Louisa, and lesser between B.H. and these other wives. But there's just something about him and that I think goes back to that early sense of abandonment at some level. Well, there are some interesting letters between him and his mother. When his first child, his first boy is born, the first child is a young lady named Ada. And Ada's very much like her dad. She's a real intellectual type, questioner and stuff. When his first boy is born, B.H. names him Benjamin, which is his father's name. And he writes to his mother and says, maybe now this name of Benjamin Roberts will amount to something. So he takes his mother's side, clearly, and when she divorces Seth Dustin and marries one more man after that, when it's clear that she and Seth are going to get divorced, he hasn't had many letters from Louisa for a period of time. And he writes to his mother and says, well, we're not so lucky in love, are we? You know, we think we make the right decisions, and then people haven't got time for us. They can't find, you know, I can write all the time, but they can't find time to write to me. And so he will take his mom's side. But you can just see this poor kid thinking, what's happened to me? And that sense of abandonment. And then to end up here, to end up in Utah and feel that sense of, I have finally found my home. He will never bring himself, really, though he'll butt heads immensely, he'll never really bring himself to say, okay, that's it. I'm out of here. I want something else. It's too important for him. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could trace his political affiliation mostly to ideology, or is there a sort of historical anti-polygamy sort of bias that informs his democratic beliefs?
I think it's a combination of two things. I think that's part of it. It's pretty typical for that generation of Mormon leaders to be Democrats, railing against the twin relics of barbarism that the Republican Party points out slavery and polygamy. It's a Jeffersonian democratic ideology. It's also, I think, because it tends to be closer in Roberts's mind with English government and politics. He's very much an Anglophile. I mean, he just rhapsodizes about England when he's over there and how wonderful it is. Everything's great and everything's terrific. And then has nothing but contempt for, particularly for Mexico. So I think it's a combination that most of the people he admired were Democrats. Most of the leadership of the church in that period of time were Democrats. Once he becomes a Democrat, he is absolutely a stalwart Democrat and will continue. And in some ways, kind of, I think, relishes in that fight. I didn't read to you much about that. That's the other big question in the diaries, is the political struggles of 1891-92. And he really feels that Joseph F. Smith and John Henry Smith and some of the others that are taking the church into the Republican Party are wrong, just generally, but wrong because he really believes there ought to be a pretty healthy two-party system. Yeah. Again, not a bad idea. Yeah. All two parties out there. It's nice to be in a place where people are talking about the election. The election was over in Utah 3 months ago. Other questions?
Bob. Between 1852 and 1877, Brigham Young demanded adherence to the Adam God doctrine. Mm-hmm. We know about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it took the church 30 years to back that along. But the Adam God doctrine demands at least two wives in the hereafter. It was a major insistence for polygamy. Anything in his writings having to do with this in the
I won't speak to his writings because I don't know the body of his writings as well as others do, but in his diaries, not a lot beyond what I've read, but it is very clear that he believes that plural marriage is in fact not only an eternal principle, but an absolutely necessary principle. And he really struggles over accepting the manifesto. As I say, he says in his diary, I could not vote to sustain it. And you can really feel, if you read between the lines, him saying in so many words, what was this all about? We've been kicked around here for 10 years, and now all of a sudden to change. Did we mean it or didn't we mean it? If we meant it, then why in the world are we going to do it? And yet he realizes that in another part, he says, I understand. If we don't make an accommodation, they're going to destroy us. You know, so I think it was a real dilemma for B.H. just for B.H. Roberts, for many folks. Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know. I think he marries Margaret after the manifesto. I really do. But my opinion is as good as anybody else's.
Was he living poorly much, though? Like, he only talked about his third wife alone. But did he have his two households before
that? Oh, he had three. And in the diaries, he takes off in the morning from Centerville. And he's a commuter. He gets on the train, goes to Salt Lake, spends the night with Margaret, gets up the next day, goes back to Centerville, goes see Celia, goes see Louisa.
Did he ever think he could have children with Margaret?
Oh, they tried. And I think, if I remember right, I'll hedge on this, but I think maybe she had a miscarriage. Yeah. She was older and had children, but I think they hoped to have children. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Well, you've been an attentive audience. I appreciate it. It's nice to be here. And Molly, thank you.